dark. You did some time to catch Jeff a left hand. You didn't like the way your tan was in the morning.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock stars.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar three. Up.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the conclusion of our conversation with Eric Clapton, Forever Man.
Don't you know you're riding with the king?
This week in the studio, Eric Clapton returns for his timeless collection, Forever Man.
Really, my method of dealing with it all is just to talk and really use the support of my friends. And whereas before I wouldn't have done that. I don't know what's happened to me in the last few years. I've kind of maybe grown up a bit to be a more open and approachable person, and also to use friendship instead of just acknowledging it, to really actually use it to help me, you know, and give it back.
Got me on my knees, dear. Begging, darling, please, dear. Darling, won't you ease my burning now? 'Cause I know I don't belong here in heaven.
Hello, I'm Eric Clapton. You're cordially invited during the In the Studio special edition with me, Eric Clapton, with Redbeard.
With the remarkably fit, active Eric Clapton having just celebrated his 70th lap around the sun by performing two nights at New York City's Madison Square Garden, once again, Eric is preparing an upcoming series of concerts at the venerable Royal Albert Hall in London. It's now an annual tradition, and Clapton talks us through why.
Do me a bit of a English history lesson 101. First of all, tell me about the Albert Hall and the monarch after whom it's named, and the love story. First of all, who's Albert?
Well, Albert was Queen Victoria's consort, and Prince Albert, really. I don't really know much about him. He's a fairly mysterious figure. That I think he was an eccentric. And if when you think about Victorian society, it was very straight-laced and proper and moral. And I think he was one of those characters that really didn't fit in.
With the times.
Yeah, with the times. But I think Queen Victoria was very fond of him. And I think he was a kind of stranger to English social life and didn't really... I think he probably had his own little set of friends and circumstances that he dealt with. But when he died, the whole point was that... Victoria was so in love with him that she built this hall and also a monument opposite in the park, which is a magnificent piece of Baroque, Gothic Victorian architecture. So is the hall itself. And they're very, very good, strong landmarks in the history of London, you know, I mean, of a time towards the end of the Industrial Revolution when, you know, England was going through vast changes, you know, and the empire was starting to wane. You know, I think it's somehow, when you play there, you still feel this sort of vibration of strange things that have happened in that hall. Not just, you know, classical music, but there's a picture on the wall of the dressing room of a marathon tournament that took place in there at the turn of the century, with two men running around the inside of the Albert Hall, running the marathon. I think a Frenchman and an Englishman.
Inside the Albert Hall?
Yeah. It's a kind of hangover of a very weird... I mean, you see, if you're English and you know about that particular period, which I don't, to be honest, but there's a sort of... It's the time of Jack the Ripper, you know. It's a time of London when it was really... had a very, very proper facade, but inside of this facade there was all this seedy stuff going on. And it's a very mysterious and kind of romantic time in a way, because the English are always like that. They've got this facade up, and even today there's, you know, a lot of things that go on that, you know, aren't recognized or maybe publicized. But at that point in time, it was a real dichotomy of the straight-laced and the incredibly moral and the incredibly immoral going on at the same time. So the Albert Hall sort of evokes all of that. And to play there is like no other place in London. There are no other venues with history, really. I mean, Earl's Court has it to a certain extent, but Earl's Court is a fairly recent building in terms of English architecture. So that's the place I came to play. And I don't really know what it is that drew me back, but it's just after the first time. The first time I played, I think, was with Cream, perhaps, when we were breaking up the farewell concert. And it's a strange sort of circumstance that, you know, that happened to be the venue. But it came up again and again and again throughout my career. And whenever we would opt for playing in London, we would always draw straws for which venue was the best. And the Albert Hall takes it because it has all of this stuff kind of stored up that you can, it's like an atmosphere that you can feel.
So you can, the performance, you can maybe draw from that?
You draw on a kind of, it feels to me like an old man's drinking club from the Victorian period. No matter who you put in there, or no matter what the occasion is, they can play tennis in there. They do all kinds of mad things. It's still got this red velvet drape gilt thing, you know, which sort of smothers you and makes you feel like you're in another time. Mm. I always, Jack the Ripper's the thing I always think of, you know. Mm. You know, these men in sort of capes and evening dress and top hats going out with naughty girls. It's all there in this place. But there's boxing matches, wrestling, all kinds of things go on in there.
First time I think the vast majority of the American you know, rock and roll audience ever even heard of it was with the Beatles, about how many holes it takes to fill
Albert Hall. The Albert Hall, yeah. It's, but you see, it's a curiosity. That's what it is. It's like a folly, what we call in England a folly. You know, there are places all over England that are called follies, which is when you get a rich, very rich aristocrat, builds something totally eccentric with absolutely no reason for being. And the Albert Hall has an element of that to it.
Originally from his days with Cream, Badge is now included on Forever Man. The annual dust-up at the Albert Hall, as Eric Clapton called it, was in fact a record-setting series of 24 nights there in 1990 and again in 91, which were recorded in anticipation of a live album release. But before that could be prepared, Eric Clapton's 4-year-old son, Connor, perished in an accidental fall from a Manhattan high-rise building.
And then, as you know, not long after we finished, I came out here to see my son, and that was a major turning point in my life. And music became a kind of side issue. It was something I couldn't and wouldn't deal with. When we brought my son home to England to bury him, these things were beginning. I mean, there was a studio situation with Russ in there, with these tapes of 24 nights of songs and mixes. And there had to be, something had to be done. Decisions had to be made. And I went, because I had such a grievous situation at home, I went to the studio and I found I was actually out of the frying pan into the fire, that, you know, I couldn't deal with it. I actually was having a better job dealing with my relatives than I was dealing with my own music. And I couldn't face it. So I handed him the whole thing and said, take it away and do with it what you will.
Have you ever, and I certainly don't ever want you to ever have to, but have you ever abdicated like that before, for whatever reason?
Often.
Oh, really?
Oh, often. Yeah, I was a practicing alcoholic, which I spent most of my life as. My process for making records was simply I'd play and then leave. A lot of occasions it was, you know, especially with people like Tom Dowd, for instance, who was a very able man and has probably dealt with musicians like of that ilk all of his life. That's what he's used to, and he's a father, you know. It was a father to me in this situation, and it was not an unusual thing for me to, you know, drunkenly get through a take of a song and then be carried away, and he would clean up. So this, in an unfortunate way, because of the death of my son, was something that I didn't want to have to go through like this, but it did. I did relinquish because of that. But I'm not, you know, I'm not proud of that. It's just that I couldn't handle it. It couldn't have been done any other way. But I'd much rather have dealt with it myself. And, you know, when I was talking about having to go into the studio to listen to this stuff, you know, after my son died, Russ was rolling things by me, saying, "Well, we've got this version of this and this version of that. Listen to this one. See what you think of that." And I didn't enjoy any of it, you know, really didn't enjoy the experience, and I didn't want to be there until this came up. And it was the only, I actually went to sleep in the studio. I lay down on the couch and they were playing Wonderful Night. I went to sleep. And it was the first healing experience I had after my son, was to lie there and just drift off to this, because it was, had there been one chink of discord in it, then I wouldn't have happened. But as it was, I nodded off and I went into a very blissful sleep until the song ended and I woke up. And so that was the first, for me, the first decision I actually made to do with this album, was that must go on. I'll like it one day. That's all I can say for now. But it's also very difficult for me because my feelings about it are so wrapped up and involved with this loss that I've had that it's a dark area for me to deal with. And it'll be a long time before I can see it as its own entity without thinking of all the other stuff that followed immediately afterwards. I just wish that right now I could like it as much as it deserves to be liked by the man who made it. If you know, you see, but I know that will come. It was the same thing when we did Just One Night. Didn't mean a damn thing to me because I was going out and playing that stuff every night. And I'm fine, okay, so you've got a tape of it, big deal. But this is a bit more than that. Because of the situation, I think it'll take me a couple of years before I can listen to this without thinking of what it means. And it will just be music to me. And I look forward to that day.
That was Eric Clapton describing the definitive version of Wonderful Tonight, which now appears on the multi-disc anthology Forever Man. Old Slowhand gives you fast service now at ericclapton.com and get 15% off store-wide entering the promo code REDBEARD at the checkout. Offer ends May 31. Next, The Agony and the Ecstasy, when Eric Clapton rejoins us in the studio for Forever Man Part 2.
Hello, I'm Eric Clapton. You're cordially invited during the In the Studio special edition with me, Eric Clapton, with Redbeard.
Thank you so much. It's a distinct pleasure. When I entered his Manhattan hotel room for this conversation barely 6 months after his son's fatal accident, I found Eric Clapton strumming a small, honey-browned acoustic guitar with a surprisingly loud, clear tone. When I remarked about it, Eric confessed to me that, and I quote, "Everything I've written lately sounds like lullabies." I felt my heart crack as we started in earnest.
Has this been good therapeutic work for you?
It was good for me to play and have a place for it to go, you know, because I've been playing ever since the death of my son, playing and playing and playing and traveling with that little acoustic guitar, you see, and not really having an output for it. So I needed something without having to make a record, because there's no point. I couldn't make a record right now. So I'm sort of storing up the stuff that I play and little songs that I write.
Understandably, unlike anything Eric Clapton had ever released before, and uncertain about how it would be received by his audience, the studio version of Tears in Heaven was placed on the movie soundtrack to the film Rush. It's now included on Forever Man. The Albert Hall turns out to be a safe port in the storms of life for Eric Clapton.
There's only two ways, I guess, a man can go when you've had that unspeakable kind of tragedy, and you can either... as you mentioned, just go stone inside, just stone cold. Or I guess it can be a catharsis, and for you it seems like...
Who knows? I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure how things will turn out. I can really only take it a day at a time, you know, just to see how I feel and how I'm recovering from it. And my method is not one that I adopted, and it wasn't a series of alternatives. It's just like the first thing that comes to me, really, my method of dealing with it all, is just to talk and really use the support of my friends. And whereas before I wouldn't have done that. I don't know what's happened to me in the last few years. I've kind of maybe grown up a bit to be a more open and approachable person, and also to use friendship instead of just acknowledging it, but to actually use it to help me, you know, and give it back too when I can. But I mean, I'll go in there. I mean, I've been writing songs on that little acoustic for the last 6 months, and I'll probably use the Albert Hall to try them out, because it's intimate. It's like you say, it's intimate, and I have the security there of seeing if it'll work. I mean, I'm already sort of trying to figure out how to do it, but I know that I stand a better chance of getting away with it there, and of getting a good response, a measured adult response, than I probably would anywhere else. And if it works, I'll take it elsewhere, or if it, whatever. But that's where I'll try it. And that's, I think, you know, we've all invested, you know, the band and myself, we've invested our love into this place. We've given it our trust, and it's paying us back.
That lazy, languid Layla version originally appeared on Eric Clapton Unplugged, the 1992 six-time Grammy Award winner, including Album of the Year. Layla Unplugged is now included in the multi-disc collection Forever Man. Still to come, Eric Clapton remembers getting the blues, which changed his life forever. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Eric Clapton for Forever Man, Part 2.
Hello, I'm Eric Clapton. You're cordially invited during the In the Studio special edition with me, Eric Clapton, with Redbeard.
Thank you, sir. Apparently, Eric Clapton was inoculated with a phonograph needle when a teenager and has had the fever ever since.
Yes, more or less. I was about 15 or 16 years old when a friend of mine, Ben Palmer, had the record, the Little Walter record, and it became like, well, the whole album became daily intake, like, you know, having a cup of coffee. That album would probably play every day in my house several times. I mean, with three albums, I think, at that time. That was the Howling Wolf album on Chess with the rocking chair on the cover. And the Little Walter album and the Muddy Waters, Best of Muddy Waters. Those three albums were my, you know, food and drink for many, many years. And all of the songs on that Little Walter album are worthy of covers, I think. All of them.
Nothing like a shuffle.
Nothing.
Watch yourself. On Have You Ever Loved a Woman from 24/9, there's some really great, and the only word that came to mind was some stinging solos, almost the way BB would phrase on this version of Have You Ever Loved a Woman. Did you realize how many people think that you wrote that song?
No, I don't believe it.
A lot of people think that that's your song, because you made it your song years ago.
That's true. I put it to use as a song to Patty, really. I mean, a song about Patty. I mean, when it was on the everything that went on that Layla album had to have a message akin to what was going on, and if I hadn't written it, it had to be something to do with that subject. So yeah, I didn't realize. I mean, you never really realize that a lot of people think I'm American too.
Still?
yeah. When I come, sometimes when I've arrived in New York from England, I mean, I give my passport to the immigration man and say, oh, you're English? Because I sing with an American accent, semi-American accent. And so, you know, it's not surprising.
Can the blues exist in a classical sense? In the sense that, I'm talking about a high art form. Blues was always, you know, it came up from the fields in the streets, but the way you did it on Old Love, it was elevated.
I think I have to risk the possibility of turning it into something too refined sometimes, because that's the way I want to go. You know, I want to always push it as far as it will go in terms of dynamics and emotional content. And I never really know if I'm on safe ground. I don't really know if it's always in the realm of good taste either. And sometimes it isn't. But because, you know, my sensibilities tell me sometimes that, you know, the blues should be as simple and basic as they were originally conceived. But I've got this desire to take everything I do a little further and just to see how far it can go.
Thank God.
Well, for me, it's a kind of no-knowledge situation. It's like ignorance. I don't know. The thing is, I have employed this band who will go with me. You know, they will go with me and they will encourage me. They don't say, oh, don't, you know, so far they haven't said, no, I don't think that works, you know. They get wound up with me, you know, and it wouldn't work if I was just employing a bunch of guys who didn't care. You know, it wouldn't work. I wouldn't be able to go where I want to go with that. So we all share that desire to go someplace. And this sort of thing, although it's a blues in its content, it actually has got a slightly different structure, and it gives me a foundation to try different things on, you know.
Have you always had the awareness to stay out of your own way? Because that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I think
that's a gift.
It's a question of not being too self-conscious about what you do. You know, you have to really got, you've really got to be very confident to make the mistakes, you know, because I do. I in the middle, you know, and there have been all kinds of things in the middle of Old Love that, or any of the songs where it's just gone too far and I'll make some awful mistake and blow it. But, you know, not often. But you've got to be able to really not listen to yourself as you're doing it. You've got to actually go trust your total belief and feelings about what you're doing as you're doing it.
That's very vulnerable. Got to be kind of scary.
Very, yeah, it is very scary.
Kind of scary with thousands of people.
Yeah. Because, you know, to me, say I'm at the beginning of the solo of Old Love, there's a point that I want to get to. And I don't know how to describe that point. But it is like an orgasm, really. It's like trying to reach some kind of musical orgasm. And I have no knowledge of how to get there. And there is no map. There's no rehearsal for it. You just simply start at point A and you arrive at point B, if you're lucky.
Yet another Grammy grabber was the Eric Clapton B.B. King bestseller in 2000 called Riding with the King, with the title song by John Hiatt. It's included on Forever Man. Eric Clapton's many musical collaborations with other big stars extends all the way back to the teaming with Steve Winwood on Blind Faith in 69 and Dwayne Allman in 1970 for Derek and the Dominoes. And since then, J.J. Cale, Robert Cray, and B.B. King.
It's tough doing that stuff. It really is tough because there's no guarantee that it will work. It takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to make those things work, usually. Because as much as we all have our connection and our origins in the same place, you know, that we all come from Robert Johnson or whoever it is that inspired us. When we get together, there can be miles of musical difference that, you know, the outside ear won't see. But the actual experience of meeting head up can be quite difficult. You know, you have to make a lot of compromises and you've got to bend your thing this way and that to, before it will fit, you know. I do sessions like this, and it's always the same. There, I mean, even with a person that would be of my same thinking and temperament. I mean, even say if I, you know, when Robert and I worked together on Journeyman, there is still that bridge to cross between one individual's way of seeing the music and the others. And I put this to the test too much sometimes, I think. And for me, in my fantasy head, I can see a way of doing it. I see how it can be done in here. In my head, but you give me the guitar and then play back the track and tell me I've got to just do what I feel is right. I have no idea. And I was surprised by the outcome. So it's really risky sometimes. It can be very frustrating.
If you weren't truly there for the music and malleable to fit in with the music, they wouldn't invite you.
I think you're right, yeah. I think you're right. I think it's because I have a sense, a really inbuilt sense of debt to the music, and to the support and love of my peers and colleagues, you know, because we do, many of us really do care about one another, and when we do well, we pat one another on the back, and that's what keeps us going more than anything else, is the love of our comrades, you know, and I work on that sense of debt, you know, that I do owe my existence and my achievements in this business to the help of all the other guys, really.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
That's good.
You can't do it on your own, man. No way.
And remember, get 15% off this terrific 2 or 3-disc set, plus everything else is 15% off at ericclapton.com, but you must enter the discount code REDBEARD when you check out. Offer ends May 31st, and it won't last forever, man. This is Redbeard in the studio, indebted to my guest, the great Eric Clapton. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and online. Visit inthestudio.net.